Welcome to the Continuing Education Podcast for CASA Volunteers, connecting you with experts who can advance your advocacy for children and families. I'm your host, Maggie Halpin, and this is CASA On The Go. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of CASA On The Go. And today we're so honored to be joined by the Honorable Judge Aurora Martinez-Jones, our guest who is going to help us unpack some advocacy strategies around working with families affected by substance abuse disorder. And Judge Martinez-Jones is really a leader in child welfare practice here in Travis County, where she leads an innovative specialty drug court dedicated to working with families struggling with substance abuse. So, Judge Martinez-Jones, I'd love to begin our conversation by just inviting you to share a bit about your background, and maybe for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, to share a bit about the Travis County Family Drug Treatment Court and how that works.
Would love to. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to do this podcast and share with you all. I have a big heart for CASA. You all are so important and vital to the work that we do. So I'm very happy to be here to share with you all. So I am the associate judge currently of the Travis County Child Welfare Dockets. I work very closely with our state district judge, Darlene Byrne. And together we preside over all of the cases in Travis County that involve the child welfare system. That's just around 1,500 children who are involved in the system, and we do court-ordered services cases here in Travis County as well, and that's what gives us very many different options to really do our best to work with families where they need the help the most. Prior to becoming a judge in 2015, was an attorney on the court appointment list here in Travis County, and I have been working with the Travis County Family Drug Court since I was an attorney. In 2008, I joined that team as one of the parent attorneys, and I represented a lot of different parents in the Family Drug Court program and was able to grow with the program and learn more with the program, as well as continuing to uphold my competency levels in issues of substance use disorder and recovery. And in 2015, when I did become the associate judge here in Travis County, I took over that docket and presided over those cases. And that's what I do now. I think we have one of the largest family drug treatment courts in the state. We have about 45 parents in our program right now, and we've been moving forward since 2007. So it's a large program, it's a long-lasting program, and we really work together with the community, with our stakeholders, and with all of the team members to continue to improve the way we work with the children and families.
Awesome. Great. Thank you again just so much for so generously sharing your time and expertise with us today. And like we were talking about before we started recording, there's just so much that we could discuss when it comes to advocacy and substance abuse. But I think one important place we can start might be talking about some of the myths or false assumptions that folks can sometimes have about people who are struggling with substance abuse disorder. For example, an advocate might believe that a parent who is experiencing addiction maybe doesn't love their child enough to get sober or is in a way choosing alcohol or drugs over their child. How would you speak to some of those concerns?
Well, I think that is definitely a great place to start. It is very difficult for parents who suffer from substance use disorder. I think traditionally people have called them addicts. One of the things that we try very hard to do is to change the culture around how we work with people in recovery and how we work with people who suffer from a substance use disorder. And so I say that and say that very intentionally because that's exactly what it is. It's a person who is suffering from a disorder, and that disorder is related to substance use. It's a diagnosis, and it is something that is a part of behavioral health and mental health issues. We have to look at it as a disease that it is, as far as not being so much of a choice, oftentimes, when you're suffering from a substance use disorder. I know very many parents in different capacities, from being their lawyers to personal friends of mine, as well as on the bench and the relationships that I've created with some of these parents. And just about every single parent I've met truly loves their child. And when they suffer from the substance use disorder, it is something that is beyond their desire and control oftentimes, and it's very hard to get into recovery. They are very strong people who are able to get into recovery, because it requires not just a lifestyle change. We hear the changing people, places, and things, and that's one of it, but it's also changing behavioral health issues, the way that their brain thinks about things, the way that they support their bodies, the effects that they're suffering from after having had a long history of use. These are all additional complications that oftentimes weigh into what their capacity is to really be the kind of parent that they want to be. And of course, a big piece of whether or not that parent is successful does have to do with where they're at in their recovery, and if they really have that desire to change and follow all of the recommendations from professionals, follow the recommendations from medical professionals, treatment professionals, therapeutic professionals, to address all of the issues that have come up from the substance use disorder. And I think that oftentimes people neglect to understand just truly how hard it is to get into recovery and maintain recovery, even as much as they may desire it. And so I think that's one of those myths that I would like people to understand as something that's just not true. These are not weak people. These are not stupid people. These are not people who don't care, especially if they have even enough within them to come to court. That's huge. I've had so many parents who do suffer from substance use disorder. They don't even come to court. And any parent who comes to court, whether they're still suffering from that disorder, if they're still actively in their addiction, if they're showing up to court, I know there's a desire in them to want to change and want to see better for themselves and for their child. And ultimately, some of these parents have to make some of the hardest decisions ever as it relates to whether or not they would relinquish their rights. And none of those things are easy to do. They're not easy to consider. And they add trauma to their life, which is sometimes perpetuating their disorder. But if they're willing to take into consideration what's best for their child, even while they're in that state, you have to acknowledge, you have to understand the difficulty in making those kinds of decisions. But I've had some of the most talented, creative, funny, enjoyable people that I know suffer from substance use disorder. As an attorney, I got to know a lot of parents very closely and intimately and understand their life and how they got to where they were. And I think that's something we fail to think about for our parents, as we oftentimes think about our kiddos and wanting to be trauma-informed. Almost every parent who suffers from a substance use disorder also has a trauma history. And we're not thinking about that when we start engaging with them and we start blaming them. And I think that is a fault in the way that we work with parents and needing to also understand their trauma history and how it's important to look at them in another light as a person who has suffered trauma and maybe having trauma responses. And some of those trauma responses have led them to a place where they now have a substance use disorder. So those are some of the things I would really want people to understand and to be highlighted as far as myths or false assumptions about people who are struggling with this disorder.
Great. Thank you so much for that. And just in thinking of the importance of using a trauma-informed approach to our CASA advocacy, I think that's key on every single one of the cases that we have the privilege to serve on. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how a CASA advocate could apply a trauma-informed lens on a case where there is a parent struggling with substance abuse. What might that look like?
Sure. Well, I know that CASA has done a great job on looking at all the different modalities that are helpful and being trauma-informed and really applying that to the work that they do with the children. I would say simply to think about ways in which transferring those same skills to parents would work as well. Some of the biggest concerns that I get from parents as it relates to any CASA on their case is that they don't feel like CASA gave them a fair shot, didn't take the time to listen to them, and really started judging them before they got a chance to know them. So one of the things I would say in the beginning is give them a voice with CASA, right? So listen. Listen to what happened to them without judgment. Just listen. And I know that as a first start would go a long way, because if a parent feels heard, and especially feels heard by their CASA on their case, they're going to start to understand that perhaps there's opportunity to build an image in that CASA's mind that they would hope that CASA could see in them as a parent. And if CASAs are able to listen to a parent and understand their own trauma history, you may realize that they are not developmentally where they should be as an adult parent. They may be still functioning as if they were a teenager, because we all know what happens to the brain when it's experienced trauma and the level of development that gets stunted if we are not nourishing and helping grow those parts of the brain from the places where it left off. Most of our parents do have traumatic history, especially as children. And if we listen and understand where they're coming from, we can apply some of our trauma-informed tools with parents as well, giving them choices. Oftentimes, whenever I'm giving court orders to the parents, I'm giving them a choice. Even though there's an order in place, they have the choice to follow the order or to not follow the order. And if they don't follow the order, I tell them what to expect, right? Another trauma-informed practice, let people know what to expect. If you don't follow the court order, these are the things that could happen. If you do follow the court order, this is what we expect to see happen. These are the choices that you have. You've got to apply the same principles to the parents as you do with the children. And you've got to take the opportunity to learn the parents. We oftentimes just start with them as adults and we don't think about their history as children, but a lot of them were in the system themselves as a child. And if you start to look at them through those eyes and through that lens, I think you can better position yourself to have the best rapport with the parent. No matter what your recommendations to the court have to be, at least you have done your diligence in looking at the whole picture, going above and beyond and looking at the trauma of not just the child, but the parent, to get a full picture of why we are where we are. And what I've seen happen when we do have CASAs that do this are really wonderful recommendations. We can move away from these cookie cutter recommendations for services, and we can really drill down into the needs of the parent that will actually get at the root cause of some of these issues. We can do drug treatment, but sometimes if we don't pair it with really good therapeutic trauma-informed work, then we're not going to overcome the addiction and the substance use disorder to get them into recovery. And sometimes we don't know how deep that goes until we take the opportunity to get to know that parent and understand how deep it is.
Great. That is such an important message. That CASA volunteers need to always remember that the parent is the expert in their own experience and their own needs and what they need to thrive and to move forward and be able to safely reunify with their child. And we know that reunification, whenever safely possible, is our priority. So remembering to build that rapport with parents and really get to know the parents' story and their needs directly from them is so important. So one message that we hear a lot, right, is that recovery doesn't typically happen overnight. It's a process, and that relapse is often a part of that process. So when a parent living with addiction becomes involved with CPS, there's suddenly this one-year deadline put in place for them to be able to demonstrate that they can safely parent their child. Could you talk a little bit about how you kind of reconcile that timeline for recovery and the timeline of a CPS case, which in some ways may not always align?
Sure. Well, specifically for the Family Drug Treatment Court, we do start off with court-ordered services cases in order to give as much time to the case as we can. Since we are supporting parents and their children going into treatment together, we're able to utilize that area of the family code to do court-ordered services with court oversight, the team involved, and court orders, but allow that child to stay out of foster care and with that parent and go with them into treatment and through the sober housing and go through the process with the parent so that parent can truly learn how to parent while they're in recovery, because that's a big piece of it. We have parents who can get sober and who can start making good choices, but we really need them in recovery and doing that recovery work and everything that that entails, which is not a simple lifestyle. It requires work every single day, but to be able to do that and manage that while they're also parenting. We had a time in our history of our drug court where we started off with TMC cases, temporary managing conservatorship, and we did find a lot of issue with getting things done within that timeline. We were oftentimes going into an extension, and sometimes that's needed. So now all of our cases involving families in recovery are in the Family Drug Court program, and some of them do start in those TMC cases on my docket as well. And what we really need to do is look at getting to a place where the any chance of a relapse or any chance of use while the parent is attempting to actively engage in recovery is paired with other supports to make sure that the child remains safe. Sometimes a relapse occurs while a parent is trying to get into recovery. In my drug court program, I hope I've done enough work to make that experience of that relapse just not fun for them. Oftentimes I have parents saying that, yes, I had a relapse and I used, but I did not like it. It is not the same like it used to be. And that's usually a good sign. It means that things are changing in their life, that they're understanding what it means to be a safe, sober, healthy parent, and that though they may have had an error in judgment or they've had a relapse for whatever the circumstance was, that they realize that's not the life they want. And it can be a building block in their recovery. That happens sometimes. What I tell the parents in our program and what I tell parents in my court who are not in the program if they had a relapse is that what I'm looking at is how you responded to this relapse and the choices that you made for the safety of your child when this relapse occurred. If they have started services and they've gone through services and they've done this through a period of sobriety, not even in recovery, they should have started gaining the tools to make safe choices for their children. We have to understand that if a parent made a choice to depend on family support, a relative placement, sometimes it even looks like a former foster placement to keep the child at the time that they've had a relapse, that is a positive thing. Making the choice to keep their child safe, although they've experienced a relapse, is a positive thing. And as we do with children, especially our kiddos who are in residential treatment centers and they make baby steps to progress, maybe acts of aggression no longer against people, but against inanimate objects, that's a small win. And we celebrate that. We have to understand this type of relapse in the same context. If a child was kept safe despite a relapse, we've got to celebrate that decision making. It doesn't mean we have to ignore it. It doesn't mean we don't have to address it, but we have to acknowledge that this was different than the main reasons that usually are why the department got involved with an unsafe situation for a child while a parent was using. If parents are able to take that relapse and then build a stronger recovery for themselves, we have to acknowledge that that relapse was a part of their road to a stronger recovery and give them that benefit of showing that that was the case. And we have to be open-minded to watching their progress. And this is on them. And one of the most difficult things to do, especially when we have CASAs who are really involved and really working to help the parents and the family, is to understand that when there are these relapses, we cannot fix it for them. Because part of the process is allowing them to bring themselves back to the recovery. We can help them and we can guide them, but we cannot want their recovery for them more than they want it themselves. And we have to be mindful of that as well, because that's the best way we can get a clear picture of the road of recovery and the strength of the recovery program for any parent who's involved.
Great. And yeah, I mean, just thinking about what I'm hearing, what you're saying about, you know, it's important to look at the different ways that a parent may be changing their coping mechanisms, such as drawing on family support to keep a child safe. And that's so important. I don't know how many of our advocates are aware that so much of the money that our system dedicates to addressing the intersection of substance abuse and child welfare is really directed at costs associated with drug testing. And so I guess let's talk a little bit more about what other ways a CASA volunteer could support children and parents in these in a case with these kinds of dynamics. So we know everyone's experience is different and people are going to benefit from different forms of support and accountability in their recovery process. But are there any specific ways that come to mind that you've seen CASA volunteers have a meaningful, positive support role for these families?
Yeah, I definitely have seen a lot of really good examples of how CASA is a strong support for families that are in recovery and working towards, you know, parenting while they're in recovering. One of the things is accountability, right? And I know that we think about accountability in a bunch of different ways. Accountability is also very helpful when we have professionals who are willing to be there to hear from somebody and hear when there is a concern without overreacting. So, for example, we may have parents who say that they are feeling cravings or they're feeling desires and they're talking to the professionals about that. Again, that's a moment in which our professionals can use that to be supportive and hold that parent accountable, or we could end up in a situation that pushes them further into a relapse. I've seen it go both ways. When a parent talks about their recovery and they talk about their cravings and they talk about any concerns that they may have and anxieties they may have, I think it's very important to guide them into a thought process of how do we take the next steps in a safe and healthy way? What is it that you can do that can help you in this moment? For the fact that they're willing to share that information before having a relapse is huge. And I think that if somebody, especially a CASA, is having that kind of conversation with the parent, they should feel very good about the type of relationship that they've built. But having the tools to know how to hold that parent accountable and to guide them in the right direction, asking them if they have a sponsor that they can call, and holding them accountable by saying, well, call your sponsor and talk to your sponsor and just check back in with me. Let me know that you got a hold of them. Not that you need to drill down and know what the conversation was about. What work did you do? Show me written documentation that you did it. You might not need all of that. You just let them know, I'm really interested in making sure you get the kind of support you need. And I think that your sponsor is the best person to talk to. Let me know at the end of the day if you reached out to them and if that helped you out. And you just follow up with, was it helpful? Was there anything that your sponsor had you do that you're comfortable sharing with me? Because that kind of relationship between the sponsor and the sponsee is a very private and intimate relationship, but it's one that's very important because I've seen a world of difference between parents if they do have a sponsor and if they don't have a sponsor. You can really tell. You can also talk about drug testing. I know that it's very difficult for the department to always get it just right, but drug testing should be random and it should be frequent. And not always do we have the opportunity to do that, but if we know what tools we have in drug testing, we can make requests that will hold them accountable. Whether or not you get a drug test that's going to be upheld in court and the lawyers are going to be happy about, you maybe don't always need that because each type of drug test you have is a different tool and they give you a different picture. And there's a way for some of them to show substances detected in that parent system and some of them to not show substances detected and for it to all be true. And so you really have to know your tools between a hair follicle or a nail scrape or an instant test or a lab verified test. But if they know they're being tested at all in any way, that's a way of holding them accountable. They know somebody is looking out. They know that they're going to have to report in. They know there's a possibility that something could come up. And to make sure that you understand which tool you have and the effectiveness of how that plays out for any major decisions that are made. But what it really takes is knowing all the tools available, making sure you're frequently checking in. But also, I think one of the best tools that people fail to think about as an actual tool is individuals acknowledging and observing the behavior of a parent. And I tell the parents this, on top of the drug testing, I'm also looking at your behaviors. Are you showing that you can make good choices? Are you making sound and healthy, safe decisions for yourself and for your child? Are you able to maintain a job? Are you able to maintain some sense of stability in your life? Because those are signs of whether or not a person has a life that is manageable because they have sobriety and maybe are in recovery, or their life has become unmanageable because of their substance use disorder. And when you see somebody with an unmanageable life, that's when you can say, well, what I notice is that you keep changing housing every couple of weeks. Well, I notice is that you keep having these situations where you're losing your things on the bus, or I keep seeing these situations where there's this lack of stability. If you talk to a person about that, rather than coming from a place that they could perceive as being accusatory, I think you're going to get a lot further in that conversation in being supportive and accountable at the same time. And obviously, one of the main things that I think we need to make sure everybody's looking at are both safety plans in the case of a relapse and recovery maintenance plans. We call them relapse prevention sometimes, but I like to think of it as recovery maintenance, because you need a plan about what you want to do when you feel like your recovery needs a little bit of help, a little bit of support. What are the things you're going to do to maintain your recovery, not just planning for a relapse? And if those kinds of plans have been made, and usually the recovery maintenance plan done with a sponsor and a safety plan done with child advocates, and y'all can have these conversations without saying we expect you to relapse, we expect to have to use the safety plan, but saying we have a plan in place, we've thought about this ahead of time, right? And we know what to expect, that trauma-informed approach again. That's also a way of being supportive and then helping the parents to be accountable at the same time.
Great. That, I think that's all so helpful for all of our advocates to keep in mind. So thank you so much. Another thing I wanted to ask you about before we start to wrap up is just the current situation with our public health crisis. I know COVID-19 has really exacerbated so many different challenges for families. Are there ways in which the pandemic has created more barriers for parents seeking recovery? And if so, have you seen any creative solutions emerging to help support parents in these times?
Right. Yes, this has certainly been interesting times. And I know it was quite concerning for me at the beginning, trying to figure out how to hold a specialty court over remote hearings is what we've been doing in Travis County. But we figured out a way. And one of the amazing things has been that there are a lot of services that are being provided remotely right now. I know that there's some really unique things happening that I hope continue with longevity, because I think it provides more access for a lot of people. I know intensive outpatient programs have moved to be remotely, and parents are still able to engage in some of those programs. I know there's a long list of online AANA meetings that are occurring, and that's been another way to keep folks engaged with their recovery. And one of the main concerns of these times has been the isolation, because for many people who are in recovery, isolation is not a good thing for their program. But when we think about it, and we think about some of the messaging that's been out there about how to stay safe and stay healthy during this time, the isolation might not be the best word to talk about what needs to happen. We need to be socially distanced, but we don't need to stop the socialization. Although we may not be able to physically be together, we still need to make sure we're connecting. So phone calls with sponsors, reaching out to other people in the recovery community are all very important things that still need to happen. And especially with some of these online services that are occurring, there's still many, many people out there in the recovery community who are ready to engage with people who need additional support and help during these times. We've been watching just kind of how everything has been playing out, and our folks in our drug treatment program have really said that they felt very supported during these times. There's still struggles, but they're still able to connect. And even when we're looking at the program and how we shift kind of the work that we do to account for these emergency times, we looked at community service, for example. We can't really do community service too much right now, although I did get some links to places that are doing online community service, which is interesting. But what we did was adjusted what we were really looking for. And so I've had parents, instead of having to do community service, I have them do a daily gratitude list. And they do that for a week to just think about, even in these times, what are the things that they're still grateful for in their recovery? And that's been very helpful. One of the other things I've had them do is to reach out. They be the person to reach out to another person in recovery once a day. It doesn't take very much time, and they can just make a phone call and just say, hey, how are you doing? I was thinking about you and just wanted to check in with you. And having them do those kinds of things that are going to help themselves in their recovery and give back to the recovery community have been things that they can do now and that are even more important now than they might have been before. And so I think that there's still opportunity to make sure we're supporting the parents who are in recovery, even during the emergency times, in that connection and letting them know that you're still there, You still support them, and you just want to hear about how their recovery is going. Have you been able to do any step work? Have you thought about any gratitudes? Have you been making contact with any other people in recovery? And even if they haven't, putting that idea in their mind that that might be something they want to do to help themselves and also to help the community. I've had others working on little projects and starting Facebook groups so that they can stay connected. So there's ways that they can do that. And we're really fortunate that the recovery community is moving with the time, and they're being flexible to the situation. And they're really finding online and remote ways to stay engaged with the folks who are out there and need that kind of support.
Great. That's it's so heartening to hear that there's been so much adaptability and that there is so much support still available for people, even in these difficult times. Well, thank you so much. Before we close, I just wanted to ask if there's anything else you want to make sure our listeners hear about this important topic. I know that there's just so much more that we could talk about, but any closing words before we wrap up?
Well, I'm just so grateful that CASA is taking the time to really dive a little bit deeper into how to work best with parents who are in recovery. I think this is always a topic that's going to be very important and relevant to the work that we do. And it's going to take a culture shift, both for a court system and also the recovery community, with how we approach working with parents who are in recovery, how we understand them, and how we support them. So I'm very glad if we get CASA on board and helping that culture shift, because I think that it will lead to wonderful things and beautiful outcomes for parents and for families if we're able to make this happen. So thank you.
Thank you, Judge Martinez-Jones. I cannot stress enough how much we appreciate you taking the time to share your expertise with us and with our network about this really important issue. And I know for myself, you mentioned gratitude lists. It's something I've been trying to do for my own mental health during this period. And I'm certainly grateful to be in this work alongside people like you who we have the privilege of getting to learn from. So thank you again so much. And to our listeners, take care out there, and we'll join us next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to CASA on the Go. Join us next time for more dynamic continuing education brought to you by Texas CASA.